Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Laura Soule.
And this is your coverage of GSA, isn't it, Laura?
Yep, it is. So Caitlin and I went to the GSA annual meeting. GSA is Geological Society of America. So this is not just paleontologists, it's all geology fields. But there were a lot of paleontologists there. So Caitlin and I went along and we spoke to lots of people about their research, which was fun.
And was it your first ever GSA?
Yeah, it actually was. So I've been to SVP before, which was the last conference that we reported on. But usually when I present my own research, I go to kind of biology, paleontology crossover conferences. So there's a big one called Evolution that I often go to, but I haven't actually been to GSA before. It was really nice, in fact, because it's geologists, it took me back to my origins, mm-hmm. my geology, paleontology roots. So I got to hear a bunch of different stuff about research that I normally am not involved in. So I do vertebrate paleontology. There were lots of invert paleo people there, so origins of life stuff and kind of marine invertebrates, so bivalves, brachiopods, all those kinds of things. Lots of taphonomy and sedimentology. So it was really interesting, actually.
All the good stuff.
All the good stuff. All the stuff that Dave likes.
And were you impressed by the scale of the conference? I mean, when I went to my first one, which was in Denver, I just couldn't believe, one, that there was a building that was that big that I was in, and two, that it was absolutely filled with people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's huge and far and away the biggest conference that I've ever been to. I can't remember exactly how many people. I think it's 10,000, something like that.
Something like that.
But it must take a huge amount of coordination. They do, it is very organized. So all of the paleontology talks were kind of in the same area. So if you wanted to switch between one session and another, you could, but there would be kind of, I don't know, 5 or 6 paleontology talks, just paleo, going on at the same time. And then all these other ones as well. And there were huge numbers of people and the queue for beer each evening was massive.
There's always a massive queue for beer in any paleontology conference.
Yeah, it was free beer, so.
Right, well, I can't wait to hear what you guys got, so I think we should just jump straight into it.
Who is an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania. We're looking at his poster. So we've got lots of pictures of fish here, I think. And you've been looking at arthrodires. Can you tell us what arthrodires are?
So arthrodire is a type of armored fish called a placoderm. So it's basically a powerful predator that slices other fish in half with its jaw plates.
And where are these fossils that you've been looking at from, mainly?
Most of the fossils I'm looking at are from Michigan, but I also compare them to fossils from Ohio and from New York.
And what question were you trying to answer when you collected this data?
Originally, I just wanted to see what was in Michigan. What do we actually have, and are there any patterns that we notice? And when I started to notice a pattern of a massive drop in vertebrate diversity, I wanted to see if this is related to other sites, if this actually happens in other places, or if this is just in Michigan.
Okay, so this massive drop in diversity that you thought you were seeing in Michigan, when did that happen?
That happened sometime between the middle and late Devonian period.
Okay, and is that in all forms of life, or is it just certain types of life that go?
That's actually in most of what we see in Michigan. So you get a loss of reefs, massive loss of invertebrate fossils, and a loss of vertebrate diversity, vertebrate abundance, and even just fossil abundance, too. You've got a lot fewer sites, a lot fewer fossils.
So you've also looked at other basins to compare the pattern. Did you find differences, or do you think it's the same?
So in the Middle Devonian, you see some differences, but a very similar pattern of arthrodire dominance with other fish kind of filling in other spots. But in the Late Devonian, you see this pattern of Michigan, huge power, you know, huge dominance of arthrodires. But in Cleveland Shale, you see other fishes taking other pieces of the cake and having a presence. Now, part of this, I believe, is because of collection bias, because of lack of work done in Late Devonian in Michigan. But I do think that the Cleveland Shale and the Michigan Basin are different, and that this pattern isn't exactly what you see in other places. So it's slightly unique to Michigan and not entirely caused by collection bias. You wouldn't see this diverse kind of assemblage that you see in the Middle Devonian in Michigan. There's definitely an environmental shift, ecological shift between these two time periods.
Yeah, and what do you think might have caused that environmental ecological shift?
So it's been documented that there's a huge influx of sediment and mud from the formation of the Appalachian Mountains in the Michigan Basin during the Late Devonian. And in my personal opinion, I think that this mud may have caused some sort of environmental change, maybe a raise in sea level or clouding the water or something. That's an area of future interest for me. But I think that this might have severely affected reefs, which would knock out all the niches for these fish and would cause an environmental disaster, essentially.
Okay, that's really interesting. Thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Sarah Minter, and I'm a recent graduate of Vassar College.
So the post that you have here at GSA is about changing shape in gastropods. So could you explain to us what question you were trying to answer and how you tried to answer that?
We wanted to understand how shape changed in the response to predation pressures. We specifically looked at whelk shells and used geometric morphometrics to show how shape changed over time.
So what exactly does geomorphic morphometrics mean?
So basically, you can take a picture of whatever you're trying to look at and use a landmark-based analysis and then quantify biological shape and turn it into numbers so it's easier to analyze.
Okay, so you kind of put marks on the pictures of the shells and that gives you an idea of like the overall shape of them.
Right, yeah. You can put different landmarks depending on what you want to look at, and then it analyzes the average shape of all the specimens you're looking at.
Okay, and what did you actually find when you were looking at the shapes of these gastropods?
So over time, in the different time periods, the shape definitely changed. And then when we compared it to predation, we saw that the shape did respond to predation pressures. The spire got higher, and then the aperture tends to get thinner as predation pressures increase.
Okay, so the spire maybe would be associated with kind of defending itself, and the aperture is, you know, that's the gap, right, that the organism...
Yeah, the aperture is the opening, and the spire just allows, if it's bigger, it allows for more of the body to be inside the shell. So it just leaves less of it vulnerable to a predator.
So you see this kind of evolutionary response, which you think is to predation. How do you know that it was responding to predators rather than something else in the environment, maybe?
It's really hard to say all the different pressures that affect shape. Predation is just one thing that we can actually quantify using repair scar data. So there probably are other factors influencing shape as well, such as wave pressure, but those are a lot harder to see in the fossil record.
And do you know what other animals were actually preying on these shells?
It's mostly crabs, like rock crabs are the biggest predator for these.
Okay, and what evidence is there for that?
So when a rock crab attacks the whelk, it'll try to peel apart at the edges of it, at the aperture. And so we can see predation by repair scars, which if the species survives, then it'll grow back over that repair scar. And you can see a kind of a line and fissure in the shell.
Okay, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chad Morgan. I work at the University of Calgary as a trilobite paleontology grad student. Currently pursuing my PhD on Middle Cambrian trilobites.
So your poster at GSA is not actually about trilobites, it's about something different. Could you explain to us what organisms you were looking at and what question you were trying to answer?
Okay, yeah. When I was working on one of my formations in Western Canada, we came across a horizon that had a lot of phosphatic material in it, and my supervisor is actually a conodont expert, so we decided to throw some of it in acetic acid and see what we got. And what came out was a bunch of phosphatic conchs of hyolithids, which are thought to be a primitive mollusk, potentially. They are a problematic group that has a lot of argument around them, but the initial idea is that they are early mollusks, possibly something like gastropods.
Okay, great. And we've got pictures of the organism, the kind of fossil remains. We also have a different picture, which looks maybe like an infilling. What is it that we're looking at here?
Yeah, so these are... internal molds that have a phosphatic palatal lining, so they have effectively fecal pellets that have been stuck inside of these shells. And there was some interesting structures on these palatal linings that we analyzed using scanning electron microscopy. And what we found was these bacterial filaments that had a high carbon signature when you looked at them for elemental composition and had a morphology similar to a lot of classic modern bacteria.
So what does that say about them? What information is that giving you?
What it's giving us is that we have some exceptional preservation in this unit, so usually we don't get bacteria preserved, and that these bacteria are probably involved to some degree in either the phosphatization or in the life cycle of these organisms.
Okay, and in your title, your very alluring title, it says cesspool preservation. What do cesspools have to do with this?
Well, the type of preservation we noticed in this unit was first identified in medieval and Roman cesspits. So effectively, Roman and medieval outhouses and what humans left behind in those areas. And so cesspool preservation is a type of phosphatic preservation where you get a large amount of organic material in a oxygen-poor environment. And the bacteria like to eat that material, and they produce phosphate ions in response, which allows for the phosphatization of organisms trapped in the cesspit.
So what kind of circumstances would you get that environment in the Cambrian? Because obviously we didn't have humans.
Yeah. So in the Cambrian, we probably got this type of accumulation from an area that had a large amount of biodiversity and productivity, probably in the water column above it. And so you get a large accumulation of their leftovers, their excretions in the sediment below.
And these infilling molds that you've got the pictures of here, how do you think that those formed?
Well, there's two potential ways. Either it could just be a packing during early diagenesis of the material, but the hypothesis I like better is that these organisms may have been packing the conchs with their own fecal material and using that as a medium to farm the bacteria that we're finding preserved. So having a symbiotic relationship with these types of bacteria.
Okay, so they would sort of grow these bacteria and then ingest them?
Yeah, use them as a food source effectively. We're thinking if these guys were living in a oxygen poor environment or in an area that didn't have a large amount of productivity, they might have been using this as a mechanism to effectively feed themselves.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
So I'm Carmen Soriano. I am a paleontologist, but I work as a physicist in the Advanced Photon Light Source in the Argonne National Lab in Chicago. And what I do is to work basically as a paleontologist mixed with physicist. So I am capable of studying fossils at very high resolution using a set of techniques. So these techniques are basically based in studying the fossils with X-rays. So these X-rays are generated by a really big electron accelerator that we use in different stations with different end instruments. We are capable of producing really high resolution images, 3D images, like the ones that I'm presenting in this poster. We study all type of fossils, amber fossils, rock fossils like trilobites, ammonites, plants. And we are also capable of doing other type of stuff. So we do elemental mapping of in high resolution again, of large and small fossils. That's something that not many laboratories, they can do 30 by 30 centimeters specimens. That's really, really useful. And then we do latest diffraction tomography. So we combine tomography with diffraction with the crystal structure of the fossil. So we can see how not only how the specimen looks like, but what's the composition inside.
Wow, that's great. So I'm looking at your poster and the images are just extraordinary. So can you tell me a little bit about the beetles? Those are the ones that you worked on, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about the study that you did on the beetles and what you can tell from using this instrument?
So I am a paleontologist. So beetles for me are really interesting. The problem is that fossil beetles are really difficult to study because the characters you need to classify them are typically hidden inside the specimen and you don't have access to them by conventional methods. So this project started over from a visit to the Field Museum. They have a really nice amber collection that almost no one has touched. So they have a really nice beetle collection. So in collaboration with Crystal Meyer, that is the curator of beetles there, we studied to look at one specimen, then two, three, and then we discovered Some of these specimens that are aquatic beetles are really strange in number. This specimen, for example, it has the head sunken into the specimen. We could extract, take out the head of the specimen and study it. So basically what we do, it's not only look at the outside, but also the inside. So if the specimen is mummified, we get to see that.
Yeah. And so is this instrument available for people to use?
Yeah. So we are a public institution. So the only thing you have to do is talk to me, send me an email. We can submit a proposal. So we have proposals available for all researchers. So you can get to work with me. You can get to work there. And really, it's really worth it. Because what you can do with this, nothing can do it.
That's amazing. So aside from working with fossils that you find in amber, what other opportunities are there?
So I have collaborators working with fossil bird bones, for example. We can do microstructure of them. You can work with plant fossils, not only wood, but also fruits, flowers, things like this. I have collaborators working with teeth, so the microstructure of teeth, really useful for a lot of people. Almost everything. Things that you have a sample size range, typically not more than 5 centimeters, but beyond that, everything is possible.
That's great. All right, well, thank you so much.
Welcome.
Hello, my name is Bridget Borsey, and I'm a master's student at San Diego State University, and I study marine mammal paleontology.
Okay, so on your poster, there's lots of pictures of skulls. What are these the skulls of?
Well, the longer one is the fossil species Paraponoporia sternbergi. It's an extinct river dolphin. It's Pliocene in age, and it's found in San Diego. The genus Ponoporia is only found in California. And the smaller one that actually looks like it was recent, it's because it is recent, that is the Pontoporia blainvillei, or the La Plata River dolphin that's found in Argentina and the La Plata River today.
So river dolphins, presumably distinct from ocean dolphins that people are familiar with?
Yes. River dolphins are distinct based on their morphology mainly. They usually have a longer rostrum and smaller eyes than dolphins that are found in the ocean. What's interesting about these two dolphins, Paraponoporia and Pontoporia, is that they have the river dolphin morphology, but they actually live in marine environments. They lived in coastal waters and estuary environments.
Okay, and is that something that other river dolphins that are alive now do, or do they just live in freshwater?
No, those mainly just live in freshwater. The other ones live in the Indus River and in the Amazon River today.
So the research that you were actually doing here, what were you trying to find out?
In my research, I was doing some basic measurements of skull morphology of both Paraponoporia sternbergi and Pontoporia blainvillei, and testing those measurements against each other using a coefficient of variation. And what I found was there were 3 skull measurements, mostly the neurocranium and the temporal fossa, both sides, that showed a very big difference in variation between the two species. And that could indicate that there were actually more than one species of the fossil pool that I had measured. However, the rest of the coefficients of variation were relatively similar, meaning that there's only one species.
Okay, so the idea is to figure out how many different species there are in these fossils that you've been looking at that at the moment are classified as one species, is that right?
Yes, I was looking at these and to see if there were any evidence that my fossil pool was more than one species.
And then are you trying to figure out how they're related to other species as well?
Yes. Further research for my master's is going to involve a phylogenetic analysis of Paraponoporia, and I'm looking to see where it fits into the phylogenetic tree of Odontocetes.
So a lot of these dolphins have gone extinct. Where do they still live?
Currently, there's 3 species of river dolphins. We have the Anaya jafrensis, which is in northern South America in the Amazon River. There's Ponoporia blainvillei, the one on my poster, and that lives mainly in the La Plata River off the coast of Argentina. And there is the Platanista gangetica that lives in the Indus River in Asia.
And the differences between the fossil species and the species that are still living, are they very different to one another, or are they actually quite similar?
There are some obvious similarities, but the biggest differences are the rostrum size. The extinct dolphin Paraponoporia sternbergi has a very large rostrum, and the eye size as well. The Parapontoporia sternbergi has a larger orbital size than the Pontoporia blainvillei, and also the Platanista gangetica today has very, very small eyes.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Steve Hasiotis, University of Kansas.
So I actually saw your talk at GSA the other day. I remember you were putting lots of animals into sandboxes. What question are you trying to answer with this work?
The question we're trying to answer is, what kind of traces do these modern animals leave behind in sand or mud or silt under controlled conditions that we could potentially identify in the rock record and use it as proxies for body fossils? Because you only have one body to give to the rock record, but you can make thousands of, if not millions of traces throughout your lifetime. So if we can understand the crawling and walking and flapping patterns animals leave in the sediment, and if they get preserved, we could cache those things in the sand or in those trays and then compare them to what we see in the rock record.
So we see loads and loads of traces in the rock record, but maybe we're not quite sure what they are. So you're trying to establish with better constraint what you think.
Exactly. Yeah, so you're basically creating a database of trackways, traces, tracks, trails, that then you can use to compare to things that have already been discovered or they have yet to be discovered.
So, what kinds of animals were you looking at in this particular experiment?
In our experiments, this recent round, we've been working with bats, mm-hmm. a variety of bats, from poor walkers to intermediate walkers to good walkers. So we're looking at their terrestrial ability.
I didn't realize there were good walking bats. You sort of imagined.
Yes. Did you know? I mean, it's a little known fact that vampire bats actually walk up to their prey and bite their prey and suck the blood. And the thing is, their teeth are so razor sharp, you never feel the penetration of the teeth.
It's pretty creepy.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy. But that's the work my student Matt Jones and I are doing. That's his master's thesis, and he was very familiar with bats. So we combined his bat expertise with my trace fossil research background for his thesis work. And it's been panning out fantastically. Because as you saw, they actually leave discrete, distinct traces that now we can look for in the rock record. I'm sure somebody's seen things like that, but maybe just said, oh, that was made by some arthropod, or maybe made by a rodent, without thinking that bats were around to do it, or that why would a bat be on the ground? But they end up on the ground for lots of reasons.
Yeah, and so could you tell the difference between the different types of bats?
Right. As of now, we can tell the difference between what would be a really good walker to a relatively poor walker, which still does pretty good. And intermediate walkers actually look like they walk like a good walker.
Right.
But probably the more important thing is being able to tell bat trackways from rodent or arthropod, and there's hundreds of thousands of arthropods that make different tracks. But to be able to identify that, especially if you remember those searching traces, where they leave these radial scratching patterns with their feet, and sometimes they leave beautiful impressions. If you were just to see that, you say, oh, that's a rodent. But now we know what the pattern looks like, and those would be bats. So that's really important.
I remember also you did an experiment with birds. What did that one show?
My student just graduated, Amanda Falk. She's a professor now in Center College, Kentucky. We're doing experiments with birds to see what kind of patterns that they would make with their trackways, and just observe the behavior. Let them do what they want under controlled conditions, like grain size of the sand in the tray, the amount of moisture, and actually see what things like, and Amanda did this really well, see what landing marks look like, what the marks of a bird taken off look like, because people have observed them and written papers, but they've never actually really showed, they just idealized drawings. But we can actually show that you can see a difference in the variation in how the feet are placed when they land. And if you remember, the landing marks are deeper than the walking and stopping marks. because of the impact of the bird. And as well as the takeoff, you can see the trackway getting wider spacing between the feet, and then the feet are stamped down and the bird takes off, and those are deeper. So before this experiment, see, people could just say, well, you just don't have preservation anymore. When in actuality, that's the record of a bird taking off.
So you're actually recording
into the
behavior.
Air. So you're recording that behavior, now we can understand it. So you don't have to do all these fancy analytical measurements. You just need to do the basic observational science of like, okay, these tracks are deeper than this. We saw what happened. We got it on video. We have the casts. Now when we see it in the rock record, we'll have evidence of actual flight. You have evidence of the bird. You have the functional morphology of the wings and the feathers. But now we can look for trackways, and they're probably already in existence of early birds, Cretaceous birds, late Cretaceous birds, taking off or landing based on the depth of the tracks and then the pattern of the tracks afterwards. So Amanda, that was her focus, and really fantastic stuff.
That's really interesting. So you're kind of building up this database of all these different animals' mm-hmm. trackways. Is that going to be made available?
Yes, actually, you can find a large number of it on our KU Ichnology website, where we have a lot of trace fossil pictures and ichnotaxonomy. We have videos of these animals. That's where we put the videos. And as the papers get published, we're actually then going to put images of the plates and the figures, and all the videos will be there. All the supplemental data will be on their website, so people can actually can see that.
That sounds like it's going to be a really great resource.
Oh, yeah.
Very much for talking
to us. Oh, you're very much welcome, Laura.
This is Paul Ullman from Rowan University. He's a postdoc there, and he is studying soft tissue preservation in bone, and he's going to tell me a bit about his poster. So can you start by telling me, what is cancellous bone?
So cancellous bone is very porous tissue that you'll find, say, in the center of a limb bone, or within the epiphyses of the ends, or within perhaps the center of a vertebra. It's very different from cortical bone, which is very dense solid tissue, which you'll find making up most of the shaft of a limb bone or in a number of cranial elements in places.
Okay, and what do you find preserved in this bone? And it looks like it does in modern animals?
Yes, when you expose the tissue to weak acid for a period of a couple of weeks, gradually it will chelate away the calcium, eat away the mineral, and leave behind any soft tissue products or any iron oxides or those sorts of things that aren't divalent. And this has been done before, mostly with dense cortical tissue, and that's led to the recovery of soft tissues like bone cells, pieces of blood vessels, and a fibrous proteinaceous matrix. What was novel with my work is that I also tested more porous, lighter weight cancellous bone. And this is just something that hadn't been tested before. Everyone assumed that the more dense bone tissue is the better place to look. So we didn't know if you could recover the same tissues in a more porous, lighter weight bone tissue.
Okay, and what tissues do you recover?
What I found was that, indeed, yes, you can find all of the same components. You can find osteocytes, vessel fragments, and proteinaceous matrix from cancellous bone as well. We should not ignore it as a source of these tissues. For the first time, I had recovery of these soft tissues from ossified tendons and from things like vertebrae that had never been tested before. So if you had a site where you didn't have a limb bone, previously we would have assumed that you're not going to have any material to search for these kind of things. You would expect to find nothing. My results show that you can still look, you still have a chance of finding these tissues to then test and see if you have original proteins and original composition still there.
So it's obviously really cool that we can find soft tissues still preserved. How old are these fossils?
These fossils are about 66 million years old.
So that's a really long time. So yeah. We find original material still preserved, but what is important about this research? Why is this really exciting stuff?
So we're trying to understand two things. First, we're trying to understand the taphonomic conditions and geotechnical conditions that can favor this kind of preservation in the first place. Having that knowledge about what stabilizes a molecule for 66 million years would be very valuable. I mean, for us in paleo, but in a lot of fields beyond us, even in medical research, how can we keep molecules stable? The second thing is this sort of information, once you reach the level of running it through mass spectrometry and getting protein peptides, that information can lead to systematics. It can lead to inferences in physiology. There's a whole new set of information in the fossil record just waiting to be explored there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
Great. Thank you.
I'm Matthew McLean, PhD student from Loma Linda University.
So I actually saw your talk the other day, which was about tyrannosaur cannibalism. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So I remember the specimen that you had was kind of a piece of bone.
Yes.
What kind of body part was that, and how did you know what you were looking at?
So we knew it was from a theropod, a large theropod, because the inside of the bone was hollow. So we, just based on size, you're looking at what has to be a tyrannosaur. And there, unfortunately, it's broken on both ends, but there's enough there that we think we can tell we're probably looking at a lower leg bone, probably the tibia. But that's something we're still working out exactly. Can we identify it down to the exact bone? And I'm pretty sure we'll be able to, but we needed to make some comparisons.
Okay, and where did you actually find this specimen?
So this specimen was found by some people that go out and dig with us. They went a little early and were wandering around, you know, just doing some prospecting, and they found it in a little bone bed that no one had dug out yet. And it was kind of just sitting there, and picked it up, and hey, there's tooth marks on this. That was exciting.
What part of the world was this in, and what age is it?
It's in the Lance Formation, and it's that's Maastrichtian, so top of the Cretaceous, just before you get to Paleocene, and it was out in eastern Wyoming.
So on this piece of bone, there are some interesting markings. Could you tell us what they look like and what you think they are?
Sure. So, you know, it's a long bone, like I said, a leg, lower leg, and the tooth marks are all concentrated on one side, and they're all perpendicular to the long axis of the bone. And so they're just scratches. And so we call those spores when the tooth drags along the surface of the bone. And they're, like I said, they're all kind of parallel with each other. There's several of them. And what's really cool is that we have one in particular where what's called a caithanichnus, which is where the denticles from the side of the tooth, the serrations, actually dragged on the surface of the bone such that it left little tiny parallel grooves. And we can know that we're definitely looking at something with serrated teeth, like a dinosaur or a monitor lizard. And you can actually measure the distance between those and compare it with the distance between denticles on a tooth and come up with what the predator was that bit it.
Yeah, and from looking at this and looking at these kind of precise shapes of these markings, what do you think was going on with this bone? Where did those marks come from?
Yeah, so we compared it with the different kinds of theropod teeth you get in the Lance Formation, so troodontids, dromaeosaurs, and there's I guess what you could call the Nanotyrannus tooth, depending on what genus you think that's in. You know, most people think it's a juvenile or subadult T-Rex. And then there's like genuine T-Rex teeth, the ones that everyone says look like bananas with, you know, serrations on them. And so when we compared it, they were definitely on the T-Rex end of that. And the thing is, the way it works is that those denticles, when they drag along the surface, they can only make grooves that are smaller or the same size as the denticle. They can't make anything bigger. So you know that, okay, we've got an animal that has to be at least this big, or the tooth, you know, tooth serrations have to be that big, and that corresponds with the T-Rex. It can't be something smaller than that. So,
how do you know that it can't make grooves bigger than the tooth?
So that was because of some studies that DeMore and Blumenschein and also some other people had done. And they had, specifically DeMore and Blumenschein, had looked at Komodo dragons, which have serrated teeth, and they did actualistic experiments with them. And that's what they found, is that when you leave those scratches, they have to be, that they can leave a smaller scratch or they can leave one exact same size as the denticle, but you just can't make a scratch that's bigger than the denticle. You know, it just doesn't work.
So this is tyrannosaur teeth scratching a tyrannosaur bone.
Correct.
So is that one Tyrannosaurus eating another one?
That's what it looks like. So they really look like feeding traces. When you look at the way animals pull flesh off a bone, they're typically, if it's a long bone, they're going to eat perpendicular to it. You think about the way you eat a chicken, you know, right, like a chicken drumstick, you're not going to shove it in your mouth like that. Additionally, they're all scratches, which suggests that it's dragging along there, and there's several of them. It's not just one. So, and it looks like there's been several bites. So it's been dragging its teeth several times trying to get something off of there is what it really looks like. So it's been eating. Did it kill the animal? Can't really tell, you know. But it definitely looks like a tyrannosaur is eating a tyrannosaur.
Are there other examples of that happening in the fossil record at all, or is this a new thing?
No, there are other examples. So from the Dinosaur Park Formation, they found definitely tyrannosaur bones with tyrannosaur tooth marks on them. The issue there is that there's two species of tyrannosaurs. There's Despletosaurus and Alberta or Gorgosaurus. So you can't really tell which one's eating which one, typically. There's a really cool paper by Longrich et al. In 2010 where they looked at bones from the Hell Creek Formation. And there are T-Rex bones with T-Rex tooth marks on them. And they look very convincing, and I think they're examples of cannibalism. But typically what you'll see is like one or two punctures or grooves per bone. You know, here we've got a bone that's just full of these scratches, and additionally that chthonicness, which that really tells us, hey, we're looking at a tyrannosaur biting this, just no question on it. So that's really exciting that we're just reinforcing what has already been found, that these things are eating each other sometimes.
I am here with Emma Locatelli, a PhD student at Yale, and she just gave a talk titled Leaves from the Sea, a Flora from the Pliocene Bowden Formation of Jamaica. Hi, Emma.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
So tell me a bit about these Bowden shell beds in Jamaica.
So the Bowden shell beds are a series of about four shell beds. They were discovered in 1859, and since then more than 600 shelly fossil species have been described, covering everything from echinoderms to gastropods, bivalves, crabs, and actually a wide variety of trace fossils as well.
Cool, but you're interested in the leaves, is that right?
I am. The leaves are pretty interesting because since the Bowden shell beds were discovered, the fact that there's been plant debris and woody debris mixed in with these shells, particularly in the finer grained deposits in between the beds themselves, they've always been mentioned, but no one's actually studied them. And so I and a group of a few other paleontologists went down to Jamaica in March of 2015 and collected the first fossil leaves from this deposit.
Cool. And can you tell me a bit about how, like, what sort of condition the leaves are in and what that tells you about the environment that you found them in?
The leaves are in bad shape. They're not flat lying, so they're often bent around within the sediment. A lot of them are folded in half. We only collected about four entire leaves. Most of them are fragmentary. There's evidence of crushing within the sediments. They're in pretty rough shape.
Okay, and what does that tell us about the sort of environment they were deposited in?
Definitely not quiet water. They were transported. The finer grain beds between these shell beds are probably the result of the debris flow and the last material to settle out, and the leaves were carried along with it, so the turbulent, chaotic, catastrophic flow.
Okay, and what types of leaves do you find?
We found a variety of leaves, so we have everything from the red mangrove, so a very common coastal species, both in Jamaica, but also Caribbean and other parts of the tropics. We also find things like legumes, so the bean family, and members of a group of plants called Lauraceae, which is incredibly diverse, but also tropical species like the avocado.
And so what do you know about the environment by the leaves that you've discovered here?
Yeah. So they're all, it confirms that Jamaica, yes, 2.5 million years ago was indeed a tropical island. But we are capturing a very wide ecological signal, everything from coastal environments where the mangroves grow to these open dry forests that cover a lot of southern Jamaica. And things like the Lauraceae, the avocado family, are getting into things that require a lot of precipitation. And at least in southern Jamaica, that means they're coming from the rainforest in the mountains. So we're capturing not only a wide ecological signal, but it further emphasizes the importance of transport in the deposition of the flora.
And what is the craziest thing about finding leaves where you're finding them?
This is the first fossil flora from Jamaica, period, the end. And it's one of the only ones ever discovered from the Caribbean. And what's so incredible about them is, yes, it's the first fossil flora, but these shell beds were deposited in more than 200 meters water depth in marine sediments. So these are it's an incredible find.
Amazing. And is this part of your overall PhD research?
It is. It is the final chapter of my thesis. And for my doctoral research, I've studied a number of different aspects of fossil leaf preservation. So everything from exceptionally preserved leaves in iron oxides that actually preserve cellular level detail, to things like the Maison Creek Lagerstätte, and looking at differences in preservation between different plant groups.
Well, and so you're almost done with your PhD, and you are going into a field that I don't think a lot of people consider when they are paleontologists and they're going through graduate school, and that's science policy. So
yes.
Can you tell me a bit about what you're going to be doing?
Sure. I don't know what I'm going to be doing exactly yet. I'm applying for a series of policy fellowships, including the Presidential Management Fellowship and congressional fellowships through the AAAS and the GSA, AGI, and AGU. I don't know what I'll be doing yet, but I will be working in an area of science policy in some way.
So about half of our listeners are in the U.S., so can you just give me an idea of what you would be doing in science policy? What does that mean?
That means a lot of different things. So that means working in congressional offices, providing scientific advice and scientific knowledge to our congressmen and women so that they can make informed decisions on the floor when they're voting, and even just helping them draft legislation that includes the best scientific evidence that we have today for a variety of topics, including, of course, climate change is a hot topic right now, but everything from national security to medical or health issues to education, national parks. Science informs every aspect of what goes on at the federal government.
Yeah, definitely.
Paleontology definitely gives a unique perspective because we have a very long-term view of life. A lot of what happens, especially on the Hill, is focused on the next year, the budget being the best example of that. It's very short-term focused, and we have a long view. So planning for the future and making sure that the decisions we make today will not affect our country or the world 20, 50, 100 years down the line, paleontology definitely gives me that long-term perspective.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for finding me.
Hi, my name is William Gertie, and I'm a paleobiologist at Stanford University.
So I'm looking at your poster, and I see you have this very big evolutionary tree here. What animals are in this tree?
Right, so this is a super tree of all of mammalia. And so it includes almost 4,000 mammal species, including the ones that I'm interested in, which are marine mammals.
So we've got some pictures here as well. This looks like a dolphin and an otter and a seal and what's it, dugong?
Yeah.
Yeah. So are these the species that you were focusing on?
Yes, I'm looking at these four groups, which represent four independent lineages of what are called marine mammals, or mammals that have since inhabited the sea.
And what question were you trying to answer by studying these animals?
I was interested in the body size evolution of these marine mammals, and specifically if there is a specific body size that seems to be the best size for a mammal that lives in the water.
And you've got this graph here as well. So we've got blue dots and then orange dots. What do the different colors represent?
The blue dots represent the sizes of the aquatic members of each of these groups. And the orange dots represent the terrestrial size of those terrestrial members of those groups.
Okay, so this is basically the difference between the aquatic and terrestrial members of groups, and they're very closely related to one another.
Yes, so these organisms are closely related to one another, but it shows that since they evolved from different ancestors, they've now evolved to different body sizes.
Okay, and did you find that the body sizes of the aquatic things matched up?
For the most part, so for manatees, dolphins, and sea lions, they all seem to have a very similar body size. But for otters, the fourth group, they don't really seem to follow this pattern.
Do you have any idea why that might be?
We're still thinking about different possibilities, but it might be that they're filling a different ecological niche, or that there might be some difference between their diet or their habit that might be causing them to be smaller.
So basically, it seems that there's an ideal body size, really, for some of these aquatic taxa to be, but otters are sort of the odd one out.
Correct, yep.
And then down here as well, we've got this analysis where you've got things that are only living that you've kind of modeled and figured out how they were evolving based just on looking at the living species. And then, is it right, you've got a different analysis for fossils?
Correct, yeah. So we weren't able to include the fossils in our phylogeny, so we did a separate analysis of the fossils, which show similar but also somewhat different results in terms of the body size evolution of these groups.
So what were the differences between the two analyses that you did?
So for a few of the groups, it shows that they actually evolved much slower than we inferred from the phylogenetic analysis, meaning that this might be a much more passive process than we imagined.
So in this case, it was really useful to do an additional analysis of fossils.
Correct, yeah, including the fossils really changed our outlook on the results that we were getting.
All right, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Of course.
Okay, I'm Steve Rowland, professor of geology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
So you've been working on Pleistocene deposits in Las Vegas. Could you tell us about the field site where you found these fossils?
I'd be happy to. This is a site that's just adjacent to the city of Las Vegas. We have a very fossiliferous Pleistocene deposit there, and the fossils that we get most abundantly are mammoths. These are Colombian mammoths, which are a bit larger than the woolly mammoths that are more well known from Northern Europe and Northern North America. And this one site, we have multiple, over 60 teeth of mammoths that are intact enough for us to determine how old the animal was when it died. And the interesting thing about mammoths and elephants in general is the teeth move laterally through the mouth, with each tooth pushing the tooth out in front of it, and each tooth that erupts is wider and longer than the teeth in front of it, and also has more of these enamel plates. And so we can basically find a tooth, an isolated tooth, and determine how old the animal was when it died by counting how many plates and looking at the amount of wear on the plates. And so what I've done in this study with my graduate student is we've taken this 60 plus plates, mammoth teeth, and determine how old each animal was when it died, and use that to construct a histogram that shows what the age profile of the population was. In this case, we had over 50% of the animals were 12 years or younger, which is an age grouping that's adolescent basically, juvenile, before they're sexually mature and you know, well developed adults, and that's typical of a fairly healthy population of African elephants in Africa today. And so our conclusion is that the population that's represented here, which ranges in age from about 13,000 to 18,000, if this is a representative sample of that population, that tells us that this population was fairly stable and healthy during the last part of the Pleistocene.
And do we have a good idea of how long mammoths would have actually lived for, you know, the oldest?
Yes, mammoths, we have good reason to think that their life expectancy was similar to African elephants today, which is about 60 years old. 60-year-old animal is a very old animal. So in their mid to late 50s, 60 years old is about the limit. And we don't get any that are older than about 48 years. So it looks like in this particular place, by the time the animal was in its late 40s, it probably was pretty old and frail and wasn't going to live much longer. And in fact, we only get a fairly tiny percentage of our population that's aged, say, 37 to 48. So most of the animals are in the prime of their life, about 25 to 36 years old or younger. And then after that, the population declines tremendously.
Okay, and you said in this fossil site, almost everything that you found was teeth. Do you know why that was?
We think that the chemistry, it was a spring, it was a pool, a spring mound, a spring pool, and the chemistry of the water, we think, was a little bit of alkaline. And the alkalinity, we think, was dissolving the bone, so that an animal would die and fall in the water, or maybe it'd be attacked by a lion or a saber-toothed cat, and the bones would end up in the water, and the the alkalinity of the water would just eat away the bones, but the teeth, because they have an enamel coating, were resistant to that. So that's why we think we're getting almost all teeth and almost no bones.
And so this fossil site is from, says the terminal Pleistocene. Am I right in thinking that this was a period of time when there actually was a lot of stress on kind of large mammals?
That's true. And that's what one of the bigger issues that we're interested in is, why did these animals go extinct just a couple thousand years after the teeth were deposited that we're studying here? And one explanation is it was a time of climate change, for sure. The climate was changing, the Pleistocene was ending, things were warming up in general, although there was some variation within that. But in general, it was a time of climate change, and presumably their food sources were changing. And so that's one of the things we're interested in trying to test, is whether or not this population seemed to be under some stress because of climate change and changing food sources, or the other leading hypothesis for the extinction is overhunting by humans who had just arrived in North America right before the extinction. And so our data at this point, which is very preliminary, but it tends to not strongly support the idea that these animals were under stress due to climate change. We haven't found any evidence of hunting either. We haven't found any mammoths with spear points stuck in their rib cages, for example. So, and we will be doing more and more research, of course. But so far, the evidence at least does not support the idea that this population was under stress due to climate change. But definitely the climate was changing. So we think that probably this population was doing okay, at least at the point that we studied them.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Sounds like there's a lot of exciting stuff still to come.
It's very exciting. Thanks, Laura.
You have evidence here for eggs associated with a trilobite. Can you tell me what we are looking at?
What we're looking at are pyrotized trilobites from the Ordovician of upstate New York. The trilobites are fabulously preserved with their legs all preserved of a mineral called pyrite, which you may know better as fool's gold. The pyrite precipitates in environments that have a high sulfur content, a high iron content, but a low oxygen content. Certain bacteria work on the decaying carcass and create the chemical conditions which cause the pyrite to come down and preserve the animal's soft tissues.
And I see these spheroidal structures, and they're right next to the trilobite's head. Now, why are you interpreting these as eggs?
Well, we tend to put our mammalian perceptions onto animals sometimes and think about them with our preconceived ideas of what reproduction should be like. But arthropods do a lot of diverse things. What we have here are these spheroidal structures in the head. They are consistent in size, consistently between 100 and 200 micrometers, depending on which axis you're measuring. They're always located in an area that we call the genal angle, which is, you can think of as the back corner of the head. They're nowhere else on the specimens. So if we were to think of an alternative hypothesis, let's say that there's some sort of globular parasite or bacteria, we'd have to explain why they occur only in this one anatomical place and not anywhere else on the animal. The size of them is consistent with that for arthropod eggs that exist today. It's also consistent with the earliest larval stages of baby trilobites that we know of from elsewhere.
And is there a modern analog where you would see this sort of thing with the eggs associated with the head?
Horseshoe crabs. Now, as a word of caution, arthropods do a lot of different things with their reproduction. Horseshoe crabs have an ovarian network located in their cephalon, in their head region, where the eggs form and develop. They are extruded out through inconspicuous genital pores right at the back of the head. The males likewise produce their gametes in a similar network and then extrude them out through these pores. Fertilization takes place outside of the animal. And this is something that if you live in the water, you can do. If you live on land, it's not quite as easy to just release your gametes out into land. In horseshoe crabs, you can see this demonstrated nicely with some videos you can find on YouTube. In Asia, there are street vendors who will make horseshoe crab omelets, and they do this by taking a living horseshoe crab, slicing open the head, scooping out this ovarian network with these small green eggs, and mixing it with the horseshoe crab's very distinctive blue blood. Horseshoe crabs have a blood that has, instead of an iron compound like we have in our hemoglobin, they have a copper compound, called hemocyanin. And so you get your green eggs, but instead of ham, you've got blue blood in your omelet.
And what are the implications for finding eggs of trilobites preserved?
I don't think I've surprised anybody by suggesting trilobites lay eggs. I think what's unique here is that I have evidence that trilobites were utilizing what's called external fertilization. Instead of copulating like land animals do, they just release their gametes into the water. The eggs that are preserved on these animals are external. Because the pyrite is affecting the external surface, they would have had to have been released outside of the body wall. I can't tell if these eggs are fertilized or not. That's a distinction that we can't make based on these preserved records here. But I think it's not too far to say that this mode of reproduction, external fertilization, is probably basal for arthropods, that is, characterizing the most primitive arthropods.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.